Thank you for tuning in to the WOLA podcast, Latin America Today. It's Friday, June 13th, 2014. I'm Adam Isaacson, Senior Associate for Regional Security Policy here at WOLA, and I'm here with three of my colleagues from here at WOLA because we all sort of overlap on this issue, and it's a real crisis. The arrival of, just in the past 8 months, about 46,000 unaccompanied minors, mostly from Central America, across the U.S. border, overwhelming U.S. Agencies and authorities' ability to deal with what is really one of the biggest humanitarian crises we've seen in quite some time. I'm here with Maureen Meyer, who's WOLA's Senior Associate for Mexico and Migration, our Program Director, Jeff Thale, and Senior Associate Mark Hansen as well, who works on several projects, but especially Cuba as well as other things. And I know the question that we keep getting asked, and I'm sure everybody who's been following the news on this wonders, why now? Why are we seeing this rather rapid increase of arrivals of unaccompanied minors as well as migrants from Central America? Now it's roughly four times as large of a flow, and almost 10 times as large a flow of minors than it was in 2011. Jeff?
So let me jump in with a couple of things. I mean, for both minors and adults, I think that what we're seeing is the cumulative effect of years of growing levels of violence. If you look at homicide rates in the northern countries of Central America, they have grown steadily, or plateaued a couple of times, but grown consistently from 2003 on. And in all three countries, they have more than doubled over that time. In Honduras, they have probably tripled.
Right.
And in some areas of Honduras, they have quadrupled. And they are at numbers that are like 20 or 25 times the homicide rate in the United States. So I think that has a huge impact, and especially on kids, the problem of gang violence has a huge and really deleterious impact. And then the other is the kind of general problem of lack of opportunity, and that and the two problems intersect, right? If you are a 14-year-old in San Pedro Sula, you're threatened by gang violence. The money that's being made is either by working in a maquila, if you're lucky, mm-hmm. where you might earn $300 a month, or participating in the drug trade, either as a gang member or in association with a cartel that's doing that's transiting drugs through the country and toward the United States. Given those options, and given the fact there are a lot of people who say no legal job opportunities, no personal safety, I'm going to leave.
Can I add? I think the important thing too is there is a big surge of unaccompanied children, but we have to think of overall there's a huge surge of Central Americans and Central American families.
There's a lot
of adults. There's even pregnant women. If you talk to the shelter workers in Mexico, they are also being overwhelmed by women and children, which they're not necessarily equipped to house, because usually the traditional migration is much more male-dominated than women, and particularly women with families. I think for case of minors, you know, threats don't happen. You know, end when you turn 18. And so I think it is also like a reflection of overall like institutional crisis of violence and poverty in Central America that's causing women with one-year-old babies to even make this very dangerous journey.
And actually, interestingly, though the most visible size of this flood is here in the U.S., the number of Central Americans seeking a political asylum or refuge in Costa Rica, Nicaragua, for heaven's sake, and other countries, Belize, mm-hmm. is I think it's up 200-300% in Mexico, right? Mm-hmm. So the surge is real, and it's not just to the United States. And although there's probably a piece of it that has to do with the fact that the U.S. is that minors are not turned around and deported overnight from the United States, nonetheless, people are going to other countries as well, and I think that's because of what's driving them out rather than some attraction here.
Now, there have been rumors here in the United States about there being rumors in Central America that there's been some sort of shift in the tone or the policy of the Obama administration's response to migrants. And of course, critics of immigration reform have been seizing on this here in the United States, sort of leaving the impression that with Central Americans that somehow kids or women and children will be let go, or they'll get a softer treatment when they get here. That, I think, is not really borne out by the numbers themselves, which show a modest but hardly a comparable increase in the number of Mexican unaccompanied mm-hmm. children. Mm-hmm. It's the Central American numbers that are really going up dramatically. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, clearly the same rumors would be swirling through Mexico if this was really something happening.
I mean, just an interesting comment. I don't think that U.S. policy overall or Obama administration policy about unaccompanied minors has changed. I mean, typically, unaccompanied minors from any country are held for 72 hours, and then, although Mexican children can be returned because deporting them is easy, Central Americans or Peruvians or Afghans or whoever, after 72 hours, are turned over to HHS for processing and handling, are given a date for a deportation hearing, and a date for an asylum hearing if they requested asylum, and then are turned over to a relative, a family member, or foster care to await that. That hasn't changed particularly. I think what perhaps has changed is that migrant smuggling organizations are trying to raise money, basically. Are trying to recruit customers by promoting the idea.
It's a sales tactic.
It's a sales tactic, right? And I think that may well be happening and have contributed to the most recent surge. But A, the Obama administration policy as a reality has not particularly changed. And B, the reason people responded to the selling tactic is because of the tough kind of underlying conditions in the region.
Yeah, I mean, a kid traveling without family members across the entire north-south length of Mexico is just a stunning undertaking with huge risks. I mean, what do we know about what the smuggling networks look like or the routes that kids are taking look like?
I think it's hard to get a full sense because a lot of times if you're with a smuggler, you're much more invisible than if you're a migrant that, say, decides to take the journey on your own and usually would ride the train or take different forms of transportation up through Mexico.
A smuggler being someone you paid, $8,000 or more to
take you? Depending on which country you're coming from, yes. I think particularly it's around $8,000 right now, the estimate. I do think, though, that in that there have been multiple allegations of smugglers certainly working with organized criminal groups in Mexico to further extort these migrants, allegations of smugglers turning migrants over or allowing them to be kidnapped by groups in Mexico. And if you look at, if you don't have a smuggler, which I think is the poorer populations, so the people that are fleeing much more out of desperation and economic necessity, they're the most vulnerable because they have no one that's paying off Mexican authorities, criminal groups, et cetera, to get safely to the U.S.-Mexico border. So they run the gauntlet of paying a fee to ride the train, and if you don't pay the fee, you could get pushed off while it's running, to sexual assault, to extortion by Mexican authorities, to any other type of horror that you could imagine in terms of the criminal activity in Mexico. And this is a very vulnerable population that we're not talking much about. We talk sort of about what's happening of why they're leaving and then what happened to them here, but not necessarily all the kind of criminal activity that preys on migrants while they're in Mexico.
The crisis is the whole way.
Yeah.
Now, we, next Tuesday, on Tuesday, are going to be releasing a report on the half of the month of February that we spent at the southern border. We went to several areas along the Mexico-Guatemala border where we visited several shelters and saw a lot of the places where folks get on the train, although a lot of the unaccompanied minors we're talking about do not board the train. And what we were hearing from shelter employees and human rights defenders at the time was they were seeing a lot more migrants from Central America, especially Honduras, the route in the northern train route leading into Tabasco, Mexico, was seeing a rough doubling of Central Americans, almost all of them Hondurans, and a lot more women and children. And folks at the shelters were saying that the migrants there, they weren't talking about any change in U.S. policy. They really were a typical conversation, and so we had some of these, was they would start saying, there's no jobs, there's nothing to eat, we're on one meal a day, we got to leave. And then you scratch it a little more, and they would say, yeah, we had some gang trouble. My sister was getting extorted, or they wanted to recruit me, or my small business was being extorted, and we just had no option. And a lot of, actually, like you said, a lot of the people don't even intend to come to the United States. They just got to be out of Honduras or whatever country they're in. So I do think that the violence is a big explaining factor. But, you know, it's another major point that we have to keep hitting. Is that the crisis here is not South Texas. I mean, it is South Texas, but it goes all the way back to the neighborhoods of places like San Pedro Sula or Downey or El Progreso, and all the way up here. And that's sort of where the approach has to be more comprehensive. Unfortunately, what we're hearing, both in the southern border and at our border, is a lot more proposals to send more boots on the ground, that the problem seems to be a lack of patrols or checkpoints or uniformed personnel. and I mean, you know, you've that Maureen, who's you've worked on Mexico's security forces for a long time, is that even something that makes sense? I mean, my impression was there were a lot of boots on the ground mm-hmm. already when we were there.
Yeah, I think, and we sort of made this in the report we're releasing as well, that it's not a lack of presence at the border. Mexico certainly has a fairly expanded now security presence particularly in Chiapas, as you know, the main state where migrants are traveling through. It's more who is doing that enforcement, and I think there is a big risk of if you were to increase even more that security presence, because you have immigration agents that are abusive to migrants, that are very violent a lot of times in apprehension operations.
Right.
You have police, particularly federal police, that routinely extort migrants and detain them and threaten to turn them over to immigration authorities if they don't pay whatever they have with them, or sometimes just a set fee to be able to continue on their journey, to just all sorts of abuse by Mexican officials. And so expanding that presence leads to more risk, because these are not institutions that are accountable. They're not, I think, looking at well-trained in terms of some of the operations that they're doing. And you have an issue of corruption as well, which I think is
a huge issue. Everyone we talked to in Mexico mentioned that.
You know, Adam, one of the things that I think is frustrating about this conversation is that we see 46,000, close to 50,000 folks arriving in, you know, this
in 8 months
calendar year, or this eight series of 8 months. But it's not as though the problem started 8 months ago. Right. Matter of fact, president after president after president, member of Congress who looks at Latin America, well, presidents when they're in Latin America and they actually take a little time to look at it, members of Congress who pay attention to these things and sit on the committees that deal with these things have been saying, we are an interdependent hemisphere.
It's part of that.
We are related with one another, and it's been that way for decades and decades and decades, and yet, and the writing was on the wall. The other thing is that the writing was on the wall. People were documenting challenges of governance, challenges of economic opportunity, challenges of violence for years, and then looking to diagnose it and coming away thinking to themselves, my goodness, some of these institutions are weaker than we thought.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, when you look at where they're spending their money, it's still on hardening the border to the tune of $2+ billion, or if you look at comprehensive enforcement of immigration, closer to $20 billion, $18 billion. Mm-hmm. And you look at what they're actually trying to do to change the environment, something that, you know, Jeff has regularly said, we know how to do. We have some good ideas on this, and yet we do these pinprick approaches and never take them to the scale where they can really be transformative. And so I think that this is going to challenge policymakers in the immediate term about how do you deal with the humanitarian crises that's here right now. But if we can't sort of also train our eyes on a longer-term series of solutions, that humanitarian crisis is going to be here for a very, very long time.
Yeah, just to jump in on that, I mean, I think it is pretty clearly true that you can't magically solve the problems of violence or problems of lack of economic growth in Central America, but are there things that Central American governments and societies can do and that we can support that would lower homicide rates, lower violence, make people feel more secure, and offer targeted mm-hmm. economic opportunities? And the answer is yes. I mean, it takes some money, it takes some resources, it takes some commitments, but it takes less money, fewer resources, and probably less commitment than it does to keep hardening our border. So I think, you know, if you look at how Los Angeles has reduced gang violence, for example, if you look at what Boston has done on youth homicide levels, those kind of community-based approaches that bring in the cops, that bring in community groups, that coordinate community-level efforts to target and reduce crime make a real difference. We've supported some model projects like that in Central America. There are evaluations that suggest they do help, and that's the kind of thing that ought to be expanded and scaled up and could help make a real difference.
Now, to date, our efforts in Central America to help those governments address the push factors of mm-hmm. weak institutions, weak justice, weak police, have almost entirely had to come through programs that were started for the drug war. They always have narcotics in their names. Does this make sense? Is this just a political reality, or are we stuck with it this way?
Well, it is a political reality, but you know, measuring the success of our programs to help prevent violence and strengthen police institutions so that homicides, when they happen, for example, are investigated and prosecuted, framing that by drug-related measures is a big mistake.
Right.
Because then what you wind up doing is saying the Honduran army has captured 27 tons of cocaine, despite the fact that they may have supported or looked away at all sorts of human rights abuses, despite the fact that crime has not gone down. It's the wrong set of measures. And if you moved away from those measures, you would and started measures that looked at increased sense of security in the part of citizens, mm-hmm. that looked at kids who'd not gotten in trouble, that looked at numbers of kids who'd stayed out of
great
sort of consolidated membership in gangs, or on the flip side, if you looked at number of police who actually go out on patrol,
right.
Number of cops who are adequately staffed and equipped, all those kind of things, you could make a real difference.
Now, just to conclude, I mean, I don't make a habit of reading or listening to right-wing talk radio very much, but when Eric Cantor lost his seat on Tuesday, I did look at Twitter, and a lot of the people on the far right of the Republican Party who are celebrating Cantor's loss were citing a lot of the people who are these syndicated columnists and others, and they kept mentioning immigration, and specifically the arrival of the minors, the unaccompanied minors, as a trigger for why people should be outraged about immigration and therefore vote out people like Eric Cantor who are not sufficiently tough. What does this mean for the future of immigration reform, which actually passed the Senate last year?
I just to say, I don't know what it means. It's not a good sign for the future of immigration reform, I think it's pretty, all of the immigration debate, I think, is pretty sad. And if you look at the realities of migrants and what their situation is, it's especially sad. But in particular, talking about kids under the age of 18 here, some of these kids are like, I was reading a story yesterday about five-year-olds coming mm-hmm. unaccompanied.
Incredible.
So you talk about something like that, and you turn a kid who has walked across the U.S.-Mexican border and been picked up and is sitting in a crowded detention center and is going to get sent to a foster home in a country he doesn't know with nobody accompanying him in a language he doesn't speak, and then you turn that into a talking point about immigration reform. I think that's really pretty awful.
And I think a lot of these children are coming because they do have family here. So their parents may have spent almost their entire lives trying to make a better life for these children in these countries, and yet they have not been able to legally bring them into the United States. So I think it again underscores why you do need to find a solution to how do you have a pathway to legalization or citizenship for all of the undocumented population in the United States, because a lot of them are families that would like to be together, and I think that that kind of feeds into why there's certain levels of violence in Central America. You've got a lot of kids without parents too that have looked to gangs and others as a way to get, you know, substitute what they didn't have because their parents are in the United States. So I think there is that need to really, the window is slowly unfortunately closing for immigration reform, but I think these issues certainly underscore why it's so necessary, and that we, as a country that prioritizes family unification, is certainly not what we're seeing right now at the border.
Not at all. It's become even more urgent. Maureen, Jeff, Mark, thank you very much. And that's it for now. Thank you for listening to WOLA's Latin America Today. Please keep listening, and please keep visiting WOLA's website, www.wola.org. You can also find WOLA on Facebook or on Twitter at WOLA_ORG. Hasta pronto.